Accession number 10688, rule 4.
Gets in real far.
The Germans attacked at a place called El Aguila. The 7th Armoured Division, which had been the division that had done the advance, had been withdrawn because their tanks were getting a bit ropey. And they needed new tanks and a lot of maintenance. And a new armoured division had gone in, quite green. The division had been spread out over far too much of an area, and they took a hell of a beating, this division. But panic seemed to set in, and we didn't retreat. It was a rout. Everybody seemed to be rushing back as fast as they possibly could, without any attempt to stop, and nobody seemed to have got any control over anybody until we got well back, until control was restored. Now, I came back from Tobruk then. I came back towards Tobruk, and we came to a place called Temimi. And I think this is the thing that stood out in my mind more than anything else. I'd become detached from my unit, and I got myself mixed up with Indian Division, because troops were getting all mixed up all over the place. And they hadn't established stragglers posts by that time. And I found myself with this, the 4th Indian Division at Temimi, and I thought, well, I'll stay here for a bit and see what's going to happen. And quite obviously, the 4th Indian were going to fight a rearguard action. And I'd never been in a rearguard action, so I thought, well, I'll stay there and study this. Now, at Temimi, the escarpment comes from the sea at right angles to the coast. It comes inland. And you can look down on the plain. That's towards where the German forces were. On the top of the escarpments, the Indians had got all their vehicles all dispersed. And the British artillery had come up to support the Indians with their 25-pounders. But there was nothing happening, nothing at all. The Indians, on the front of the escarpment, on the face of the escarpment, the Indians dug themselves in there, facing the plain. The 25-pounders were on the escarpment behind us. And I think it must have been, we stayed there all day, and it must have been in the middle of the afternoon when we suddenly heard sound of machine gun fire. And I could see on the plain down below either two or three British armoured cars, and they were coming back towards the escarpment, and I could see two or three German armoured cars going in the other direction. There was no aircraft over to Temimi that day. So obviously the armoured cars had been in contact, and they were doing a reconnaissance both sides, and they were coming back to report. Our armoured cars disappeared from my view, and everything still remained quiet until, I suppose, an hour later, maybe a bit more than that, suddenly 12 or 15 personnel carriers, German personnel carriers, appeared from across the plain towards us. And then they came so far and stopped, and then the infantry got out of the personnel carriers and started to move forwards towards the escarpment. At this point, the Indians opened up with their automatic weapons, and the Germans opened up with their automatic weapons, although they must have been about 800 yards away. And you could see the Germans making use of the ground. They were obviously very skilled soldiers. They were making use of the ground, the cover on the ground, the hillocks and the wadis, and moving forward towards the base at the foot of the escarpment. Then the 25-pounders started to fire from behind us. We could hear the shells coming overhead. It didn't seem to be doing any harm to anybody. And the Indian troops seemed to be, well, they were perfectly happy. You could hear them chattering away to each other and talking to each other. The face of the escarpment, of course, was all rock, and apart from bullets, the bullets were chipping the rock and there was rock flying all over the place. Then the Germans started to use mortars. The first thing I knew about the mortars was suddenly there was a bump behind me, because the mortar bomb doesn't make a loud noise when it goes off, and a bit of smoke and a white patch. But our mortars hadn't got the range that German mortars had got, so the Indians didn't use mortars. They didn't open fire with the mortars because they couldn't reach the Germans. And they peppered the top of the escarpment with mortar bombs. They had no idea what they were trying to hit because they couldn't see anything, but they just fired off a lot of mortar bombs and a lot of machine gun fire. Our 25-pounders went mad. And this went on, I suppose, for the best part of an hour and a half. And it was a very exciting business. The Indians were highly trained troops, there's no doubt about that. And the Germans were highly trained troops. All professional soldiers, all working to the book. Every move that was being made on both sides was the correct moves to make in the circumstances. Now and again, a man was shot. And he was simply carried away and taken to the rear. And as it got towards dusk, the German fire seemed to slacken off a bit then. And when it got dark, obviously they retired, and the Indians, they eased off in their... you could see their tracers then, after dark, they eased off. And I think it was around between 8 o'clock and 9 o'clock at night, we got orders to... I didn't get any orders because I was a stranger there. But the Indians obviously got orders to move back, and they all joined the transport and we all drove away back towards Tobruk.
Was it a frightening experience at all?
No, it was a very exhilarating experience. I found that all during the war. I found that any kind of action was exhilarating. I liked being in the army and I liked being at war. And a lot of us did. I mean, nowadays people say, oh, it's a terrible thing, war. And it is a terrible thing. But if you're involved in it, some people enjoy it. And we were trained to do that job. And that's the job we were doing. No, it was an exhilarating experience, I find, all the time. All the time.
Did you speak to any of the officers of the 4th Indian Div?
Yes, but I don't know who they were. They were British officers. They were British officers.
Do they seem confident?
Oh, yes, yes. They're professional soldiers. They were regulars, yeah. Oh, yes.
Do you know the date of that rearguard action, approximately?
No, the date I can't say, but it must have been a month to 6 weeks after the advance.
What do you recollect of the rest of the retreat?
Well, we retreated from there to... Tobruk, but Tobruk was held at that time. I came back then to Egypt and started to rebuild the overhead route I had previously built, which had been destroyed by that time. And that is the time when the danger arose from a German fighter aircraft who flew along the route and became extremely dangerous to work in daytime, 28 feet up in the air. I think after that, as far as I was concerned, things were very quiet until the next advance, which was in November 1941. The British troops advanced, I think, and caught the Germans on the hop, although there'd been a lot of fighting in between, but pushed them right back again. But simultaneously, or at exactly about the same time as the advance started, I think I would be around about Merz Matru somewhere, I was told I'd been promoted and had to report to Port Said to go to the Far East.
How did you react to that news?
I don't remember having any reactions at all. I just got the orders to go and I went.
Had you been following what was happening in the Far East?
No.
But this Did you get the news to go after or before Pearl Harbor?
Before Pearl Harbor. I got in November 1941. December, it was December Pearl Harbor, I think, wasn't it?
Yes. Whilst you were in North Africa, your unit was the sixth line of communication signals,
was it?
That's right. How did a signals unit like that relate to a division?
It didn't. It was line of communication formation. Except that they gave us tasks to do in relation to divisions when it came to such things as laying field cable and connecting up squadrons, tank squadrons, at night time when they leaguered. That really was our speciality, of course. But we didn't relate to a particular division.
How did you get out to the Far East?
How did I get out there? Well, I went to Port Said and we went on board a tramp steamer called the Silver Teak. That's in that document there, in fact. But we went from there to Colombo, and we had 5 days there, and then we went from Colombo, we were to land at Rangoon. By the time we got to Rangoon, the Japs had overrun it. And so we turned about and we sailed back and landed at Bombay. And that took 42 days from Port Said to Rangoon and back to Bombay.
So did you actually land at Rangoon?
No.
But you were in the harbour there?
No. We didn't even see land. Obviously they got orders to come back.
When you landed at Bombay, what were your instructions then?
I hadn't got any instructions. It's in there. Nobody knew who I was.
Can you tell me the story of that?
Yes, I've got it in there, but I can tell you the story. We got off the ship at Bombay, and we were taken to a camp outside Bombay called Calaba Camp. And I immediately started to make inquiries about 17th Indian Division, because that's the division I'd been posted to. Nobody seemed to know anything about 17th Indian Division. Nobody seemed interested in me. And I kept insisting that I wanted to leave Bombay and get across India and get into Burma. And they were rather amazed that I should want to do that when I was sitting in a nice camp with a nice bed and in a tent and getting 3 square meals a day. And so I decided to go down to the railway station and see if I could get a train from Bombay to Calcutta. Now, I didn't have a movement order. And in the army, you're not supposed to move without a movement order. So I inquired in the camp if I could have a movement order to go to Calcutta, and they were very vague about that. I don't think some of them knew what a movement order was. But I knew at the station I'd find a railway transport officer, because at main stations there was always an RTO. And RTOs were a peculiar breed of officers. They were a bit dim-witted, really no good to anybody, so they made them RTOs and stuck them in the railway station. And they issued railway warrants and supervised troop movements. So I went and saw this fella at the station in Bombay. And the first thing he said to me was, "Where's your movement order?" And I said, "I haven't got a movement order. I'm on secret business, and it's very urgent, and I have to get to Calcutta as quickly as possible." So he said, "Well, I'll give you a railway warrant." So I went back to Calaba camp and saw the paymaster and said, "I'd like 1,000 rupees, which was £75, because I had to feed myself as I crossed India. And I got the £75 and went back and got on the train. And I stopped at a place called Jubbulpore, because I knew there was a Royal Signals depot there, and I stopped there. And I spent a few days there and had a few good meals. And then I went on to Calcutta, and I went into Fort William. But I still couldn't find a way of getting into Burma, and I then found that there was a battalion of the Gloucestershire Regiment. And I met a Sergeant Major in the Gloucesters, and he told me they were leaving Calcutta to go by train to a place called Tinsukia, which was on the northern, right at the northern tip of Assam, on the Chinese-Burmese frontier. And they were going to be flown from Tinsukia to a place called Michina. I can't spell that. So I thought, well, I'll keep an eye on the Gloucesters. And I think it was in about a week, following Friday, they started to move out. So I let them move out, and after they disappeared, I got a taxi and went down to the station. And I waited until they'd all boarded the train. Then I just walked onto the platform and got into the last carriage. And off we went. Well, there's no facilities on the train. And the train had to stop, particularly in the evenings. The train would stop and we'd all get off, and the cooks would cook us a meal. Then we'd get back on the train again, and we'd go on a bit further until we got to Tinsukia. And we went into a tented camp there. And there were flying troops into Michina every day. And all I had to do was to wait my turn. But after a week, they reversed the process and they started to fly troops out from Michina back to Tinsukia. So I thought, well, I better get back to Calcutta and see if I can find my way into Burma from another direction. But I went down malaria. And I got... I was quite ill, and I eventually got into a little field hospital which was staffed by Burmese doctors and Burmese nurses, and I got a bed there, a charpoy, but there was no food, so I couldn't have any food, and I was there for a fortnight without any food. And one afternoon there was a dispatch rider came in, and he had the blue and white Royal Signals armband on. So I called him to come across to my charpoy, and I said, get me out of here, go back to your unit and get me some transport and get me the hell out of here. And that's what he did, and he got me back to his unit. It was a small detachment, and they were monitoring Japanese wireless traffic. Well, I had a few days there, and then I got on a train and set off for Calcutta, and I can't remember the name of the place I got to, but... I had a relapse of the malaria, so I got off the train, and there was troops coming in from Burma then. They'd been coming in on foot, and the place was full of troops. There was no accommodation, and the food, there was very little food, but I managed to get into a tent with an RAF corporal, and he poured all in dysentery.
These troops were in the Great Retreat from the Japanese advance.
That's right.
Of February 42,
that's right.
March 42.
Yeah. It took them all that time to get... So it took some of them 6 months to get back into Assam and India. I shared a small tent with this RAF corporal, and the monsoon was on, and there was inch or two of water on the floor. You had to lie and sleep in that at night. So I got fed up with that, and I thought, well, not very well, but I'm going to get back on a train. So I got back on a train. And I got as far as Calcutta. Then I went to a place called Barakpur, where there was a transit camp. And nobody knew me there, but they fed me and gave me a bed. And I stayed there about a week, and I was in my bunk when I had somebody call outside, "Are there any Royal Signals here?" So I came out and saw this Lieutenant Colonel, big tall man with a big moustache. And I said, "Here." And he said, "Where have you been?" And I said, "The Middle East." And he said, "Get your kit and get onto my jeep." Because Middle East men were, they were looking for men from the Middle East if they could get them. And he drove me into Calcutta.
Was that because of their experience?
Yes, yeah. He drove me into Calcutta. And I was given a bungalow, beautiful bungalow. Spotlessly clean, could have a bath and a shower, and live the life of Riley when I got back there. And this was a new division that was being formed, 26th Indian Division. And I stayed there for, we were in Calcutta, I think, for about 8 months while we formed up. We had to take new men, and they're all recruits. We had to train them all.
When would this have been about?
That's 1942. That would be February, March, April. The monsoon had finished, so it must have been May or June, I should think. May or June. But the monsoon had finished when I got back to Barakpur. And we took in all these recruits and to train them, and my job was obtaining equipment, wild sets, rations, transport, all the various things. Now, I was very, very busy. And the CO sent for me and said, I'm going to promote you to regimental quartermaster sergeant, which made me quite pleased. And we finally finished all our training and get supplies. We had transport. The transport was taken away from us, and we were eventually given mules.
I think that we can say that you were promoted, by the way, on the 17th of November 1942,
That's
so
right.
that helps to
That's
date
right.
it.
Can you tell me about the mules that you had?
Yes, these were Argentinian mules. They were very big mules. We became very fond of the mules. I think everybody became fond of the mules. And these poor animals we had, of course, were devocalized. Because in Burma, of course, we couldn't have any sounds at all. We couldn't have mules objecting to things by making a noise. They carried two panniers, and they carried 180 pounds weight. And they were in teams of three. We didn't have Indian muleteers. We looked after our own mules, British ranks. And we groomed them. They were groomed. No matter what happened, we groomed our mules. And when it came to grooming, everybody in the unit, from the commanding officer downwards, attended on the grooming parade. Because we wanted to keep our mules in perfect condition. They couldn't tell us if there was anything wrong with them. They could get saddle sores and that sort of thing. And they couldn't tell us, so we had to examine them carefully every day to make sure that they were always fit.
Did they suffer from the climate?
No. That didn't seem to affect them at all. I think on one occasion I got to the point almost of tears with a mule, because a zero had flown over the crest of a hill, and as he came over the crest of the hill and downwards, he opened up with his machine guns and he hit a mule. And when we went to the mule, it was standing eating grass, and all along one side were bullet holes, and the animal's entrails were coming out through these holes in its side. It didn't seem to feel any pain. It just stood there quietly eating some grass. But of course, we dispatched it pretty quickly.
Was that in Calcutta?
No, that was in Burma itself. No, we didn't have any Japanese fighters in Calcutta. We had a funny experience there when they sent some bombers over. And they dropped one or two bombs in the middle of the city. I think the only person that was killed was a British sergeant who was full of rum or some other kind of drink, and he ran out into the street and just happened to the bomb drop near him and killed him, which taught him a lesson.
Whilst you were in India in 1942, the Indian National Congress staged what they call the Quit India movement.
That's right,
to
that's right.
try to drive the British out.
That's right.
Do you have any personal recollections of that?
The only time I saw Congress people was in Bombay while I was... I was only in Bombay a few weeks, but during that time, when I went to the railway station, there was a demonstration going on, and the Indian police came along with lattes, you know, these are huge long bamboo poles, and got stuck into this crowd of agitators. But apart from that, I met some congressmen later on, who seemed perfectly reasonable people. But that's the only time I ever saw any demonstration.
Did you feel that the police were justified?
Well, I think at that time, things were, again, it's learning after the event. At that time, the Congress were becoming a grave embarrassment to the government. They supported the GIFs, that was the Japanese Indian forces. These were men who had been taken prisoner and recruited by the Japanese and formed into infantry units to fight against the Indian army. The Congress people supported the GIFs, and I think that they were becoming quite an embarrassment to the... But in India, when it appears to me when there's huge demonstrations, the police don't seem to hesitate there. They just get the letties and they get stuck into the demonstrators.
What did the British forces in India feel about the Quit India movement? Was there any sense in which you felt you were being stabbed in the back?
I don't think so. I don't think we ever thought about it. It really wasn't our concern. Being in the army, that was something that really didn't concern us very much. We knew something was happening. For instance, in places like Bangalore, it was quite unsafe to go out after dark because of the nationalistic feelings of the people there. They would attack you at night if they caught you after dark. But no, we weren't really concerned with their political aims. Certainly the Indian Army, the troops weren't interested in them. The Indian Army, I think, particularly the volunteer army, which is the biggest volunteer army the world's ever known, were more patriotic and British than the British were.
What was the reputation of the Japanese army at that time in 1942 after these initial victories? Was there any? Were they held in great awe?
I don't think they were held in great awe. They were held in great fear because of the stories that we'd heard. And I believe that the reason for that was that the troops in India, in Burma, when the Japanese attacked, were quite unprepared and untrained to combat them. There was a lot of myths talked about the Japanese, and we know full well from my own experiences that in deep jungle the Japanese were pretty clever, but they couldn't fight in the open. And if you get Japanese troops in the open, our better training and firepower were far superior to the Japanese. Nor had they any initiative. British soldiers, even down to privates, if they're cut off from their unit or a battalion, whatever it is, do have initiative.